Today's Teisho will be on Case 89 in the Heikigan Roku, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 89 is entitled Ungan's The Whole Body is Hand and Eye. Ango's introduction: when the entire body is the eye, while seeing, you do not see. When the entire body is the ear, while hearing, you do not hear. When the entire body is the mouth, while speaking, you do not speak. When the entire body is the mind, while thinking, you do not think. Putting aside the entire body, if there are no eyes, how do you see? If there are no ears, how do you hear? If there is no mouth, how do you speak? If there is no mind, how do you think? If you are familiar with this point, you are in the company of the ancient Buddhas. However, putting aside being in the company of the Buddhas, with whom should you study Zen? Main subject: Ungan said to Dogo, "What use does the great Bodhisattva of mercy make of all those eyes and hands?" Dogo said, "It is like a man straightening his pillow with his outstretched hand in the middle of the night." Ungan said, "I have understood." Dogo said, "How do you understand?" Ungan said, "The whole body is hand and eye." Dogo said, "You have had your say, but you have given only 8/10 of the truth." Ungan said, "How would you put it?" Dogo said, "The entire body is hand and eye." Secho's verse: to say the whole is all right. The entire is also well said. If you take it conceptually, however, you are a million miles away. When the giant rock spreads its wings, the clouds of six directions vanish. Its wing beats lash the seas of the four realms. This is raising a speck of dust, much bleating, but a little wool. Don't you see the net of jewels reflect each other? Where does the eye of the staff come from? I cry, tut, tut. I want to thank everybody for coming here this morning to practice on this beautiful spring morning. I hope you had a wonderful sit. Most people, in growing up, begin to become aware of kind of a separation between themselves and everything else. I don't know when exactly I first began to notice that, you know. I guess there's no moment in your life when you begin to notice that you're separate from other people and from everything else. When I was a little kid, my parents moved from Northern Virginia to Baltimore, Maryland. There was a naval base in Baltimore, and my father was working there, a military installation called Fort Hollowbird. And those are really where my memories start, you know. I remember actually moving into the empty apartment. And then I went to kindergarten, and I think I went to school up through the third grade in Baltimore. And until then, I don't have very many memories. I a couple times remember going up to my mother's family in upstate New York and being with my grandparents. And I particularly loved my grandfather. who was a big man. He was a big, he was like tall, and he was fat, and he was a French-Canadian man. And he had snow-white hair, and my hair is getting to be like his hair. And he really seemed to love me, you know, a lot. And he just really showered me with affection. And of course, as a little kid, I didn't know why, but I just knew I really loved my grandfather. And even now, I have a tremendously warm feeling when I think about my grandfather. And my grandmother also I loved very much, and she too was very kind to me. And so going to see my grandparents was really wonderful. I just have the best memories of being at my grandparents' house as a little boy, and my grandmother always had some ribbon candy. It's a kind of candy that's almost disappeared from the world. It's a kind of hard candy that was extruded to look like ribbons. It's a little bit like a candy cane, but it looked like ribbons. And instead of being red and white, it was many different colors. So it actually looked like people had taken ribbon and bunched it up. But it was actually candy, very hard, crunchy candy. And my grandmother always had some of that in the credenza, in the dining room. And so when I would go to visit her, it was like one of the first things I'd ask about was the ribbon candy. And I can just remember being in the farm, in the house there on their farm. Sometimes we would go up in the winter. These are some of my earliest memories. And it was so warm and pleasant in the house. And my grandmother loved to cook, and she would make breakfast, and the smell of coffee was in the air, and donuts. She often made her own fresh donuts. And so the whole thing was like a wonderland for me. It was really beautiful. And when we moved to Baltimore, that was the first time I had to deal with other people, you know, like not my family. I had a little brother, Peter was his name. And I didn't yet have a sister. My sister wasn't yet born. My brother and I would play on the farm when we would visit my grandfathers and grandmother. But when we moved to Baltimore, it was really different because for the first time we had to deal with other kids. You know, it was like I was just becoming a person. You know, I was just getting old enough to be aware of something beyond my family. And we moved to this new environment that was really not, it was really different. You know, it was very complicated. There were a lot of kids in our apartment complex. And some of them were older than I was, and they had like gangs. They formed gangs. And the big kids, as we called them, were kind of scary, and they might beat you up. And I remember going to school, and it was very difficult. You know, it was very challenging to go to school. I had wanted to go to school because I had watched television, and there were programs about going to school on television, and school sounded very exciting, you know. There were shows like Lassie and some other shows in which kids would go to school and they seemed to have a good time. But going to school in Baltimore was kind of scary because there were a lot of tough kids. And people would push other people around. So one of the first, you know, that was like a shock to me. Coming from like a very protective environment and suddenly being in Baltimore and having to go to school and encountering these kids who were tough and, you know, could be violent, that was scary. Even now, you know, I actually feel nervous about it. And that was my first experience of like other people, you know, one of my first experiences of like other people. And so it was very complicated. It was very complicated. That was like my first experience of like being separate, you know, separated from other people. And I can remember a lot of experiences that were challenging. You know, like I had our neighbors were two girls, Lynn and Carrie Morrissey. And they would always drag me into their games, you know. So I would go over there and play with them. And they had you know, like a party. They put on a party, and they had dolls and things like that. And I would play with them. And then I had a friend, Mark Miller was his name, and he really made fun of me for playing with these. With these girls, you know, and playing with their dolls. And I began to get a reputation, you know, for playing with these girls, so I had to stop playing with the girls, and I was very worried about it because, you know, it was ruining my reputation as a boy to be playing with these girls and their dolls. And I remember also there was a bully. There was a guy in the apartment up above us. His name was Bobby Westbrook. And he didn't have any father. It was I didn't understand that at the time, but he didn't have a father. And his mother was raising him by herself. Maybe he had never had a father. But Bobby was like an unhappy kid. He beat up a lot of kids in the neighborhood. And I remember having a lot of tension with him. And he said, I want you to be my friend. And I was scared of him, you know, so he would come to the house and he'd say, let's go out and play. But he was kind of frightening to me. You know, he wasn't usually happy, and he was scary. So I would try to get away, and then he'd say, you're not my friend, and he might beat me up. So it was like I had to be his friend or he was going to beat me up. And, you know, I've talked about this before, but my mother came from a very poor part of the country, and she was very unsophisticated in a lot of ways. And when I first went to school, she dressed me up in this outfit that was like putting a target on my back, because my mother used to watch she was fond of a movie that I'm sure you've never seen, but it was called Little Lord Fauntleroy. It was a sensitive little British kid and his trials and tribulations growing up in this very rich world, you know, British world. And he was this cute little kid with curly hair. And my mother dressed me up in an outfit that was like a British schoolboy's outfit and sent me to public school in Baltimore. So I had a little cap, like a Boy Scout, like a Cub Scout cap, kind of, but it was a British schoolboy's cap. And I had, you're not going to believe this, but she sent me with shorts and stock, you know, like long socks. It was like, it was like asking for death. And my mother, you know, she was from a part of the country that was very isolated. So, you know, when she moved to Baltimore, it was like a mind blower for her too, you know. And of course, I did get, you know, I got ridiculed for the clothing I wore. And you know, just getting to school in Baltimore was a challenge without getting beaten up, you know. And I remember there was a kid named Mike who was a couple of years older than I was. And Mike just seemed so cool to me. He had it all together, you know. He didn't wear the kind of clothes my mother bought. He had like a jacket that was sort of like a cool jacket. And he just seemed at ease. He seemed to be at ease. But, you know, for me, social life was very challenging. Going to school was challenging. I remember the one thing that I really liked to do as a kid was watch TV, because it was like an alternate universe, you know. So I used to watch TV, and one of the shows I used to love was Zorro, which is probably something else you've never seen. There used to be a TV show on called Zorro. And it was starring this handsome American who later played the dad in Lost in Space. I can't remember, Guy something. But he was so dashing and handsome, and he played this mysterious Mexican, masked Avenger. And he had a secret compartment in his. He was rich, and his father was a landlord, and he had a secret compartment under their hacienda where he kept his horse, and he'd go out at night and fight the authorities. And I just loved Zorro. He was so sophisticated. And I would watch that show and just dream of being Zorro, you know. But outside, it was very frightening. And I remember watching a lot of TV, I guess. So, you know, those early experiences, I think, greatly, maybe yours were different, you know, maybe yours were much more pleasant than that. But somehow, you know, we form an image of ourselves as separate, you know, and maybe it's these little traumatic events that do this over time. Then we try to fit in, you know. One response to this is to try to fit in, you know. And so we work very hard to be accepted, acceptable. After we lived in Baltimore for a while, my parents moved to a place called Bowie, Maryland. This was a town that sprang up. It was a mass-produced town. And it was built all at once, and all these people who worked for the government moved in. It was really like housing for GI families, people who had fought in the war, and they had the opportunity to buy houses. Most of them came from families that had never owned a house. So we moved into to Bowie, Maryland, and we moved into this house, and I went to a new school, and I realized now that I was at this new school, I could be a new person. So I really didn't want to be like my old self. You know, I really wanted to be more like Mike. And so I tried to be different. I tried to be a little more outgoing and a little more cool. I tried to be, you know, like a cool guy. And I tried to be interested in sports and things like that. But I was such a, you know, as we used to say, I was such a spaz, you know. I was really bad at sports. I had very poor coordination, and I always struck out at bat, you know, that sort of thing. So I couldn't quite do it, but I tried very hard to fit in. I really wanted to be accepted by other people. And this had a lot to do with, I guess, forming my basic attitude, you know, towards other people and towards myself, you know. I was fearful, and I was trying to fit in, trying to be acceptable to others. And I think these experiences, maybe your experiences are quite different from mine, but I think these dynamics are almost universal, you know. I suppose there are people who are very confident, you know, very confident in themselves. I was reading a book about Franklin Roosevelt. And apparently Franklin Roosevelt grew up in a very privileged background. He had very good parents, and he had incredible self-confidence. When he was young, when he was just out of college, he was already planning to be president of the United States. And people, somebody had asked him, well, you know, like, what do you mean you want to be president of the United States? And Roosevelt actually said, I can't think of anybody better. Really, he had like, so I guess there are people, you know, he said, when I try to think of somebody who would be better, I can't think of anybody. I'm sure, clearly the best. So I guess people have like different upbringing, you know, they have more. I think Roosevelt had like an unshakable confidence, but most of us don't have that, you know. We grow up, when she was a little kid, my mother was very unhappy, and my mother let my sister become really quite overweight. And my mother, I think, actually somehow encourage my sister to be overweight, because my mother was so unhappy. She would buy like sweet things for my sister to eat, and my sister ate a lot of junk, you know. And my sister became overweight, and then she suffered because she was a target of other little girls' ridicule. And I can remember her sitting in her room, very sad, because the other little girls didn't want to play with her, and she had her tea party set up, and I had to play tea with her, which I hated, and of course, which, you know, made me a target of ridicule. If it got out that I was playing tea with a girl. So you know, my sister too had a lot of problems being acceptable to other people. And she suffered a lot from rejection and so on. This is so common, right? I mean, my brother was like the exception, because for some reason he was able to be popular. He was like the only person in the history of our family who had ever been popular. And my brother was very handsome. You know, he was like the handsomest kid in the family. I often think my brother, you know, he was just, unlike me, my brother had, when he was a little kid, he had this beautiful body. You know, my brother had like excellent muscles. He had broad shoulders, a small waist, and he was just very his body was just superb, and he was very athletic. You know, my brother was like a super athlete. I have been a, you know, jogger, but my brother was like, he could rip across, and he could run. You know, he was so fast, and he was so coordinated. My brother had excellent coordination, and you know, he was, and the girls loved my brother. You know, when we would go to the pool, you know, all the girls would come and go, hi Peter, you know, and I would just slink into the pool, you know. And my brother was so handsome and so charming, and he knew how to, somehow he knew how to inspire the admiration of others, you know. You know, I think he had many moments when he was quite depressed. When I think back on it, he often felt alone, oddly, you know. I think my brother worked very hard to be liked by other people. You know, when people started to have, when it became fashionable for men to have long hair, I didn't know about it for several years. The trend, you know, was, I didn't know about the trend that cool guys had long hair. I was trying to get good grades in high school because that was how I was hoping to become acceptable. But anyway, my brother, he seemed to sense the trends, and so he was like, he had long hair and bell bottoms long before anybody else, you know, I knew. He was very cool, you know. But even my brother had these moments, I think, when he was quite alone, and he was quite quite sad because he was alone, you know. So I think this is really basic element of human life, you know, this idea that we experience our separation from other people, and it's acutely painful, you know, and it calls into question who we are, and we spend a lot of our lives trying to overcome that separation by being acceptable to other people, right? And yet I'm not sure. You know, I'm not a psychologist. I never took a psychology course. I'm not an analyst, or I don't have any background in any of that kind of knowledge. But just speaking from my own experience, I think this dynamic is hugely important for people. You know, and it goes back even before our relationship to, say, friends. It goes back to basically like our relationships with our parents. You know, I mean, I can remember my father was very worried about me because I I liked to play with dolls, you know. I love TV, and I liked movies. I liked, you know, like melodramas and things like that. And I would take my sister's dolls sometime, and I would make them act like the figures in TV, right? So I'd put on little plays, and this worried my father tremendously. And I remember he bought me a football outfit once, and he gave it to me as a present, and I tried to be so happy, you know. It was, he must have spent, we didn't have a lot of money, so he spent a lot of money on that football outfit. And it was, you know, there was a helmet and everything, and he gave it to me, and I tried to look very happy, and he said, "You're a red-blooded American boy." Meaning, I'm very worried that you might be gay. You know? I mean, that's what he meant. And of course, I think I only wore it once. And my brother, of course, who was always trying to get my father's approval, he was the one who went into football, right? You know? And the irony was, you know, my brother, for some reason, my brother could never please my father. You know, so this was, you know, this goes on. These dynamics are always present. So, you know, I think by the time you become about 17 or 18 years old, you're just totally caught up in this desire to be a person others will accept. You know, I think this is hugely powerful. And I think we're looking all the time for cues about what we should be doing, you know, what we should be doing. This is so human, right? And we're constantly trying to find that acceptance, you know. And I think often we fail at this. And one of the things we do is to sort of push that aside, you know, constantly pushing it aside. And we just keep going forward thinking, I'll get it right, you know. And but it's very hard. And I think at some point we get to a point where we realize, you know, this is not working, and I'm unhappy, and I don't know why, but I'm unhappy. And I think sometimes people come to something like Zen because they don't know what else to do. You know, that their strategies are not working out very well. And I think Zen is really quite unique. It's really, I think, quite extraordinary, because it's sort of like starting all over again, you know, with the way we interact with the world. You know, so, you know, we've been trying so hard to be acceptable and pleasing to others. And we've been trying so hard to be handsome or beautiful or intelligent or, you know, whatever, manly, womanly. And we've been failing, you know. On some level, we know it. And you come to Zen, and it's like starting all over again at the most elementary level. It's like my relationship to the world starting with this moment, right? And you sit down on the cushion, and, you know, this is all about, like, re-experiencing the world, but in a different way. You know, starting from zero, starting from, like, the most elementary aspects of existence. We sit on the cushion in this strange way. And I never understood why we did this, you know. I was listening to a radio show, and they interviewed Temple Grandin. I don't know if you know Temple Grandin, but she is an autistic woman. She's become quite famous because she was able to overcome her autism and become a specialist in animal research. And she says, she claims, and I think it's probably true, that her way of thinking is much closer to the way of thinking of animals. She's really a very interesting writer. But she studied animal husbandry in college. And she's really tried to change the way animals are handled on farms and in industrial production. So, you know, when cows are brought in by the hundreds from the ranch land and they're moved into feedlots and things, They're often terrorized during the whole process. And Grandin is very astutely aware of the way animals experience the world. She's very sensitive to that. And she's designed different kinds of paths for them to walk on, and she's very aware of how they experience. So she's changed the shape of the railings and everything that that steer the cattle, and they go through very calmly. They're very relaxed, not at all frightened. So anyway, they were interviewing Temple Grandin, and she was talking about the fact that she had, as an autistic person, she had tremendous problems interacting with other people. It was like she could not guess how they were perceiving the world. You know, she just couldn't, on the basis of her own experience, get it right. On the basis of her own experience, she constantly misguessed how others were perceiving things. And we all do this to some degree, but for autistic people, it's very severe, you know. And she said she would get so nervous that she would be paralyzed by anxiety. And then one day, she noticed that, I guess she'd grown up on a farm, she noticed that when cattle were held in this device that held their bodies still, it squeezed them, they became very calm. There's a device that when you're like, veterinarians are examining calves, they put the calf in this device and it clamps onto the calf's body, and instead of getting panicky, the calf instantly relaxes. And Temple Grandin actually made a little machine for herself that did the same thing, and she calls it deep pressure. And she said when she was overcome with anxiety, she'd jump in this little machine that she built. She called it her squeeze machine. And she'd put pressure on the upper part of her body, and it would make her totally relaxed. And I thought, that's it, you know. When we sit in this posture, you know, especially if you, you know, it's like a squeeze machine for your lower body, you know. You put a lot of pressure on the lower body, and it actually it makes you feel very grounded, you know. Like half lotus, you put a lot of pressure on your thigh. Full lotus, you put a lot of pressure on both thighs. It's like a squeeze machine for your legs. I know that sounds crazy, but she understood the way pressure on the body, she calls it deep pressure, affects you. You know, it makes you calm. And I think we sit on the cushion and we put our legs in the squeeze machine, basically. And somehow putting pressure on the lower body is deeply relaxing. And then we breathe through the hara. We do deep abdominal breathing, which is very relaxing and very energizing. And then we just begin to focus on the breath. And it's like the most elemental experience, right? How do I interact with this moment? It's very uncomplicated, right? It's very simple. But, you know, we have, over the period of our lifetime, we've developed so many habits. You know, we're expecting to be beaten up. You know, as we enter the next moment, we're expecting to be beaten up, to be ridiculed, to be rejected. You know, we're expecting to be frightened, maybe physically punished. We're expected to be rewarded, we're expected to be complimented, and so on and so on. And, you know, basically, the moment tends not to do any of those things for us, actually. And so we can go through a long process of confusion, and it could be even anger. You know, there are people who come in here to meditate on the beginner's night who leave and they're actually pissed off. Because somehow the moment didn't give them what they were looking for. But anyway, you know, if you stick with it, you begin to have a new relationship with the moment. You know, it you're not punished, you're not rewarded, you're not complimented, you're not ridiculed. You know, there's a kind of being which is like unconditional being, right? It's just being there. And, you know, if you stay in that state of like unconditional presentness, the interesting thing is that the desire to be a self, to be like noticed and approved, it begins to diminish. And so does the sense of like separation from everything, you know. And, you know, this can take a long time. You know, you can go back to this, to the moment, back to the breath. It takes a long time to sort of work through all of these habits we've acquired. But eventually we're just in the moment in this way that's unconditional. It's present unconditionally. And it isn't judging us, you know, and it isn't asking for anything from us. You know, and this is like a very beautiful, in my opinion, very beautiful state, very healing and restorative. And you know, it's really like in Buddhism we actually have a word for this state, which is tat-ata. It's thusness, you know, the pure presence of the moment. It's not asking anything of us. It's not judging us in any way. It doesn't expect anything, and you can't really like make a deal with it, you know. It's just there, and this is tremendously healing, and this is the foundation, I think, of meditation. You know, really, this experience of pure presence, and in this pure presence, you know, people feel very good, generally speaking. It's really a beautiful state, and it's very liberating, because you know, you begin to experience the world in a fundamentally different way. You know, I think it's not a source of anxiety. It's actually like a very well. What often happens when you're in the moment, repetitively, is that the sense of separation disappears, and there's this sense of like connectedness, like deep connectedness, or safety, or security. And this is not trivial at all. This is quite important. You know, for some people, when they enter this state on the cushion, it's the first time they felt that experience in memory, in their lives, maybe, that they can remember. You know, sometimes we experience that naturally, you know, like it's a beautiful summer day and you go outside and you're not expecting anything. You just sit down and the trees are beautiful and the birds are singing, and you suddenly feel like this boundary between yourself and the world disappear. So we do have such moments, you know. They're rather rare, though, because we're so caught up in like trying to be accepted, trying to be fulfilled, worried that we're not fulfilled, you know. And so this elemental sort of like re-education that takes place on the cushion, I think it's really important. We experience the world in a way that's very deeply this deep sense of connectedness, this deep sense of security. And I think all of Zen training follows from this. You know, it's like now we're going to re-experience, or we're going to go through every aspect of our lives using this as like our starting place or our standpoint. You know, and this, you know, this is what we mean when we speak about like a deep samadhi, this sense of deep connectedness, this deep presence. It's very still. It's very stable. And you have the deep pressure on your legs, right? And we're going to go through everything from this standpoint. This is really like how I think Zen, one way to understand how Zen works. And then after that, we're going to go a little bit farther each time. You know, we're going to deal with this aspect of the moment, or we're going to deal with this aspect of life. And the koans are sort of like saying, let's start at this place where you're not, you know, in deficit mode. You're not worried. You're not feeling inferior. You're not feeling out, like an outsider. You start from this deep connectedness, which is not a fantasy. It's right there in front of you. And let's start experiencing different aspects of life. And of course, it's challenging, right? Because when you get into that state, it's like heaven. It can be like heaven. That deep samadhi state, that sense of connectedness, is just like heaven. It's very beautiful. And then, you know, the teacher might give you a koan to work with. And when you're working with the koan, suddenly you confront something in your life once again that's been a problem. You know, there's a koan about, it's called Seizei is Utterly Destitute. Seizei is Utterly Destitute. And it's about a person who says to his teacher, I'm utterly destitute. And, you know, you're supposed to take the koan and say, utterly destitute, utterly destitute, utterly destitute. You know, and you internalize utterly destitute. And, of course, all of us have felt utterly destitute. You know, all of us have felt like something fundamentally is not present in our lives, you know. And so when you work with the koan, you know, basically you sort of like, sooner or later you'll realize that this is part of your life, this feeling, you know. And so, you know, Zen practice is all about working through that. For you, that experience might take a very different form than it did for me, you know, but being utterly destitute might mean, for me, I have my own meaning, you know. When I was we've all felt utterly destitute at certain points in our lives, right? We've all felt. I guess the time I felt most utterly destitute was when I was hitchhiking across the United States. You know, I had read Jack Kerouac's On the Road. And I wanted to be like Jack Kerouac, you know, because he hitchhiked across the United States, and he went from New York to San Francisco. And when he went to San Francisco, he met all these cool poets and artists, and he became a famous poet in the San Francisco literary scene. And On the Road is all about his hitchhiking across the country, and meeting interesting people, and having these cool experiences, including smoking marijuana and things like that. And so I thought, oh, that would be so wonderful to be like Jack Kerouac. So I decided to hitchhike across the country. But it wasn't like that at all. It was very lonely, you know, actually, the first time I did it. And I didn't meet a lot of interesting people. I spent a lot of time standing by highways with my thumb out, and getting taken in these car rides for 100 miles, 200 miles, 300 miles, and getting dropped off in the middle of nowhere, and sleeping like by the side of the road in my sleeping bag. And I remember getting up one morning and just feeling utterly destitute, right? And when I was working with that koan, I can remember other times in my life where I felt, you know, utterly destitute, like this feeling of separation, of like, you know. So, you know, basically Zen is about working through those moments, sitting with those experiences, and working your way back to this pure presence, this pure presence. And we go through this process of experience, of sort of working through our sense of separation, our sense of not being good enough, or not being acceptable, you know. And we keep going through this process over and over again. And little by little, I think it really does deeply change us. And the goal of Zen practice ultimately is to have that experience of presentness or connectedness whether we're on the cushion or off the cushion, in every circumstance, you know? And it's especially difficult to have that sometime when we interact with other people. I mean, probably most of our sense of separation comes from experiences of interacting with others and not getting the response we want, you know? And so a lot of Zen practice leads back to, how shall I put it? A lot of Zen practice is off the cushion in our relationships with other people. And those relationships are like, well, you can spend a lot of time on the cushion and you can be very accomplished in your meditation practice. You can answer many koans. But when you're off the cushion and you encounter people who are difficult to deal with, who don't accept you, or who are not responding in the way you like, this is like the elemental problem, right? This is like our elemental problem. You know, this is how that sense of separation was created to begin with. So it's really like the test of our practice. So a lot of practice takes place on the cushion, but a lot of practice takes place in our interactions with others. And it's very difficult. This is what practice is all about, finally, right? Is experiencing, in any circumstance, that sense of deep connectedness, that sense of deep security. And, you know, it's life koan, life koan. When I deal with other people, the one thing I try to be aware of is the moment when I begin to fear them, or feel that there's a kind of tension between me and them. You know, when I'm interacting with other people, when I begin to feel there's a kind of tension, that's like a warning sign for me, you know, I think. That feeling of like a tension arising. And I begin to try to control the situation, you know, control the interaction. It's like I will go to like I'll have a conversation with a colleague where I work, you know, and you know, say hi, how are you, good, and then you know they'll say something that makes me feel a little bit uneasy, and I begin to feel this sense of tension arising, you know. And I want to like control, at that moment, you know, I have this powerful desire to like control the situation, like control the situation. Or I have this powerful desire to like push this out of view, you know, like I don't, like, you know, I just don't want to deal with this. So I walk away thinking, oh, well, that doesn't bother me, or that, you know. I think that's a really key moment to be aware of, where there's a sense of tension arising. You know, and what I try to do is, you know, in those moments where I've become aware of that tension, I try to like watch my breath and get into that mind that I have on the cushion, where I'm letting things unfold naturally and not trying to control the situation. This is like Zen training off the cushion, right? You know, when you begin to interact with other people and the circumstance is creating this sense of tension, that's how I would describe it, you know. There's a desire to, like, try to control or surmount or win, you know. There's a desire to get control of the situation. Or there's a desire to just push it out of the way, you know, like, everything's fine. What I try to do is get to that, you know, watch my breath, become aware of my breath, and there's a mind that isn't trying to control anything. It's just letting things unfold It's like you're a neutral watcher or you're a witness to events as they unfold. You know, you just try to be the watcher, just the watcher. And I find it tremendously helpful to interact with people in this mind, you know, where I'm just the neutral witness or the neutral watcher, the impartial watcher. And you can go through, let me just say, like anybody else, I have moments of real that are really challenging in my life, you know. I work in a place where not everybody's happy. There's a lot of tensions and jealousies, and sometimes things can be swirling all around me. But if I, you have to be sort of like mindful as you go through this, and you begin to look for the sense of tension arising. And when that happens, you know this is going to create the separation. This is going to create the anxiety and fear, self-loathing, whatever. And so you make a point of watching your breath, and you begin to try to find this mind, which we have on the cushion, right? Which is the impartial watcher, the witnessing mind. You're just watching things unfold in samadhi. And if you work at it, you can preserve this mindset as you go. It takes a lot of work. It takes just as much work off the cushion as it does on the cushion. But once you've done it on the cushion, you can begin to do it off the cushion, where you're just going through events as the watcher. Right? It's like they're unfolding by themselves. Right? There's nothing you can do to change the course of these events. They have to unfold just the way they're unfolding. And so you're going to be present with them without the desire to control them, right? And you can be responsive to things in this mind. You can be, in fact, you can be beautifully responsive if you're strangely not trying to control things. And when this happens, you begin to have this sense, or you may begin to have this beautiful sense that everything around you is unfolding like, it's like a dance, or like, this is just like a piece of music, or, you know, it's like a movie, you know, and you're just watching, and it's all unfolding as it has to unfold, and you're sort of serenely present in it all. And part of it all. Now, this is very difficult. In my opinion, this is the most advanced state, you know, actually, of integrated awareness. So this takes a long time. But when this is happening, you're present as part of something beyond yourself that's unfolding. This is like the highest state, as I say. It takes many years of practice to achieve this state. But this the unified mind in accord with the way, right? All self-centered striving ceases. Doubts and irresolutions vanish, and life in true, we should say, trust is possible. Everything is unfolding just as it has to unfold. And I'm not trying to control anything. I'm just trying to be present with it, a present witness to it, right? And then there's usually this beautiful sense of everything unfolding like a dance or like music. It's just like everything happens on cue. It's like, and now he comes through the door. Perfect. And now this happens. Perfect, right? This state of mind is very hard to achieve. It, as I say, it's the highest state. It's the fusion of deep samadhi with action, right? When you're in this state, everything is, it's like the boundary between the self and the world drops away, and everything becomes like one life, one life. You know, in representations of Guanyin, of Canon, of Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, she's often shown with many, many hands that are helping hands. You know, she has one hand holds a pencil, one hand holds a scalpel, one hand holds a mouse, a computer mouse. One hand holds a adding machine. One, you know. So these are, in other words, humans have all these capacities to help others. And Guan Yin represents the spirit of, you could say, compassionate helping. And she has all of these tools at her display. Whatever you're good at, you can use to help others, see? And Ungan says to Dogo, what does the Bodhisattva of Mercy do with all those hands and eyes? You know, in other words, when the Bodhisattva of Mercy tries to help other people, how does she do it? Does she say, oh, I must help these people. I must make the world a better place. Does she say, holy crap, everything's falling apart. I've got to step in before it's too late. Does she say, these ignorant slobs, you know, I've got to save them, you know. No. It's like adjusting your own pillow in the night. You wake up at night and you think, where is that pillow, right? And you just adjust it. There's this kind of intimacy with what's unfolding around you, right? It's the intimacy that comes from trusting totally. And so you're not helping other people with this sort of like messiah idea or sense of desperation or sense of, it's just like adjusting your pillow in the night, right? And this is like the highest state, you know, the highest state. And, you know, we sometimes get this, I think, at Sesshin, right? You know, you can get off the cushion at Sesshin, and you come into the kitchen and you wash some dishes, and you're just washing the dishes and you're being with the moment. You hear the water and you're scrubbing the dishes, or you're wiping the plates, or you're chopping the vegetables, and it's just perfect, right? It's like everything's just unfolding naturally, you know? This is like so hard to achieve. You know, Sesshin is like special because we simplify everything. You know, in real life, you know, you have a boss, you're chopping the vegetables, and your boss comes in and goes, you're not chopping fast enough, right? Or, not like that, you know, like this, you know, and, or, you know. But this is what we're aiming for. This is what we're working for. This, the unified mind in accord with the way, you know, we learn how to achieve it on the cushion first. And then, you know, we have to take it off the cushion and into the world. And of course, as soon as you know, we encounter other people, we begin to fall back into that same old mindset, you know. Oh no, I don't fit in. Oh no, I'm going to get beaten up. I'm going to get punished. I've got to be acceptable, right? And that mind is the desperate mind. You know, that mind is a desperate mind, you know. But there's this other mind which isn't trying to win or lose. You know, it's the impartial witness to the moment. If you can do this, you know, I urge you to try it, like just walking around one day. You know, try to be in samadhi mind as you walk around, as you buy groceries at the grocery store, the impartial watcher, you know. Very hard. But if it's off the cushion samadhi, and you know, the goal is that this eventually you can preserve this mind anywhere, you know. And the challenge is when somebody rejects us, or somebody isn't polite to us, or somebody isn't responsive in the way we want, and then we fall back into those old patterns a million times, right? A million times. But you know, if you believe in the process, you pick yourself up and say, okay, I just fell out of my beautiful unified mind, but I'm just going to go back to my breath, I'm going to be in the moment, and I'm going to try again. And that's the Bodhisattva's way, you know? Beautiful path. And sometimes you get it right, and it's just beautiful. And it's like anything else. With practice, you get better. You know?